Accession number 24925, reel 9.
This is the fifth reel of a taped interview with Don Anderson in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 25th of the 3rd, 2003, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Don, I wanted to speak about your involvement, continuing involvement, in the Air Force following the end of hostilities. What were you to do?
Well, when the end came, I was doing a Spitfire course at Cressy, and I finished that and went back to 508 Operational Training Unit at Williamtown. And then later in September, I was transferred to 34 Squadron, Moratai. Prior to that, I was posted to 33 Squadron. And on the way up to being posted to 33 Squadron, they said they were disbanded and they were going to take all pilots on 33 Squadron to go into Australian National Airways. And my brother Bill said, you can do that any time. Let's go and have a look at the islands and have a look around. He said, that's a marvelous opportunity. So whatever my brother Bill said went. So anyhow, he arranged for posting to 34 Squadron, Moratai. And I operated out of there for quite some time, three months. And during that time, I'd fly a DC-3, or Dakota as they're called, over to Labuan Island, went to Tarakan, various places, but including the places I went, Labuan Island. And on Labuan, there was a Mustang wing, 77 Squadron, 81 Squadron, and 76 Squadron. And I thought it'd be rather nice to fly Mustangs. So I saw the CO over there and said I'd like to get on to 77 Squadron. And he said, leave it to me.
What was the reputation of the Mustang?
Oh, they were very fast. They were long range. They were a long range fighter. The Spitfire could only, with very good fighting aircraft, but short range. It was a defence weapon, the Spitfire. The Mustang was a long range attack weapon, which could climb up very high, high ceiling of maneuverability, and very fast, and it was the latest thing, and I thought that'll do me. And later on, I got this posting from 34 Squadron to 77 Squadron, Labuan. I went over there on the, I see it was the 31st of December 1945, I went to Labuan. Remember, there's a great party, New Year's Eve that night. And we had about 4 months in Labuan. And we were sent off to Bykov, British Commonwealth Occupation Force in Japan. And we were to fly up there.
What was it like to be in the Air Force, even though the war officially was over?
It was very good. I enjoyed it. I considered staying on in the Air Force very seriously. But then I remember once, later on when I was up in Japan, a thing that put me off it a bit, there was an aircraftman was absent without leave. He came in at 1 o'clock in the evening instead of midnight, and he was confined to barracks for a month. And I thought to myself, it's a bit draconian in a way, and surely that's what we've been fighting for the whole war, to stop this sort of thing. So I went off joining the Air Force.
What was your understanding of going away to Japan? What were you being briefed in relation to your duties there?
We just had to we had to occupy the place to see that there was no uprising, because we expected the Japanese to rise, and we didn't know what was going to happen. But the thought was there that there could have been trouble up there, and that's where they were to police it, I suppose. But it was quite an experience, and we flew our Mustangs.
Tell us what it was like to fly a Mustang, given the other planes that you fly.
Oh, it was very stable and very manoeuvrable, and it was much easier to fly, I think, than the Spitfire.
In what way?
You had good visibility. The controls were, I think you could say, they were more positive. I flew them for about a year. I didn't get too many hours on them. I only got about 100 and something hours on the Mustang. But I enjoyed flying them. To do a roll, you just push the stick over and you'd roll, no trouble. It's very, very simple. It's a simple aircraft. I remember when I was first got onto Mustangs, there's a fellow called Neville McNamara, who later became the chief of the Australian Air Force. He was my instructor. And I went out to the aircraft, and he got an aircraftsman to... he said, this aircraftsman will show you where all the controls are, and when I taxi out, you follow me and take off. And, of course, never having been in a Mustang, it was a bit daunting. I'd flown Spitfires before, but the aircraftsman showed me what to do and where to push and where to pull. And we started up, and I followed him out. And we did it. It was the first time I'd done a takeoff in formation, which I thought was rather daunting, but all went well, Labian. And he got up to... about 4,000 feet, and he said, "Well, Don, I want you to put it into a spin." And I said, "Nev, no way." And I said, "I'll climb up to 11,000 feet and put one in." So he said, "Oh, well, all right." So I climbed up to 11,000 feet, and I put it into a violent spin, and it took me till about 4,000 feet to get out of the spin. I wasn't used to flying the aircraft. And anyhow, we became firm friends, Nev and I, and we often laughed about it. And anyhow, we had our 4 months in the islands. We're getting a bit sick of it. We got quite glad to move on to Japan. And the first stop of place to call was Manila. And Clark Field, we landed there. And I can remember they were refueling an aircraft, the Americans. They always seem to be a bit more casual, the Americans, than the ground crew I'd been with. And I remember this fellow was refueling the aircraft, and there were puddles of fuel all over the place. And he was smoking, and I said, "Put the cigarette out, for God's sake." And he flicked his cigarette into a pool of petrol, and it went out. And I was completely shaken to think this could happen. Anyhow, there was no fire. And we had about a week in... Clark Field, and then flew on to Okinawa. And we had to wait there quite a while at Okinawa because they were waiting for weather. To do this flight, they had bow fighters, which were our navigators, also mosquitoes, which were to lead us there. They had a navigator to get us there. And they also had a Catalina, which would scout out ahead of them and see if the weather was all right. I remember at Okinawa, a fellow called Damien Miller went out, and there was a report that there was a tidal wave of 20 feet coming in and so many miles an hour, and we're all a bit worried about it. And Damien went out and came back and reported that the tidal wave was 2 feet high and doing 5 miles an hour, so it wasn't too bad. Anyhow, we took off the next day to fly to Bofu. And 76 Squadron lost a couple of aircraft. I think it was three aircraft. They ran into a hill. They were slightly ahead of us. And they were led by a mosquito. And I spoke to one of the people on the flight there, and he said there was a flight of four. Could have been more, I can't remember now. But they saw the mosquito, low flying, getting under cloud, hit the water and just disintegrated. So they were on their own. But just before the mosquito had hit the water, he said the next course will be 318 degrees. That was from this point that he went in to Bofu. And anyhow, they saw these two or three aircraft hit the hill, and the rest climbed very steeply, and then headed off to Bofu, and luckily they got there. So that was it was a bit of a dicey do, but we didn't have any trouble. One of the people who went in was Pilkington, who joined the Air Force with me and Pierce. Anyhow, we landed at Bofu, and we were greeted by the advanced group of the squadron who had gone up there with some cold Japanese beer, which was delicious beer. I forget the name of it. And then we had I had a year up there in Japan. But part of the year, I don't know why, but they made me they put me in charge of the guard, and at one stage we had to go up and guard the Emperor's Palace in Tokyo, which was a bit of a lurk. And we went up there. We had New Zealanders and Australians, and there was Americans. We all took turns at guarding the Emperor's Palace, and I went up there and took a contingent up there.
What was the general feeling in relation to this situation in Japan? Obviously, the Americans now coming in to revitalize the Japanese.
There was the feeling all the time that there could be trouble. There could be trouble. We weren't absolutely certain. A guard had to be put around the camp, and we expected trouble, and of course we didn't get any trouble. But I can remember a story up there going around that, to give you some idea of what the Japanese thought, and it was supposed to be true, that the Americans had taken a census or an opinion amongst Japanese schoolgirls about an impressionable age of about 15, said, now, supposing you were to marry and your husband told you to do something, whatever it was, cook the breakfast or whatever, and you said no, and he were to cut your head off because you disobeyed. Because the Americans were saying that women are equal, and the impressionable Japanese girls all said the man would be perfectly correct to do that. It was his right. So things have changed a bit since the Americans have been in there. Now, whether that story is true or not, but it was told in good faith, and I believe it.
How was MacArthur seen?
The what?
MacArthur, how was he seen?
A strong man. He was we didn't give him much thought, really. He was the head of the occupation force, and we had our own army up there, whose headquarters were at just west of Hiroshima. What is it? I forget now. But anyhow, we didn't have a great deal to do with the army or navy.
How then was the emperor seen, the Japanese emperor?
Oh, he was treated as a, from the Japanese point of view, he was treated as a god. And I remember saying to a Japanese man up there, Hirohito, a very bad man. And the Japanese replied, "No, he's our father. He's very good." So they still very loyal to the emperor. Then
What was the general atmosphere, the general vibe coming from the Japanese people?
Well, they did everything they were told. There was no trouble. We had no trouble at all. They were very obedient. And they were, if you gave them a job to do, they'd do it, and they'd do it well. There seemed to be no problems at all. But we were posted up to a place called Miho on the north coast of Japan to do a rocket course. There was an RAF Spitfire squadron up there, and I can remember the CO of the RAF squadron got one of his wing commanders to say hello and welcome us there, and the wing commander had known Australians before. He greeted us by saying, "Nice to see you, bunch of bastards," or words to that effect. And his English commanding officer was absolutely shocked. And of course, it didn't worry the Australians too much at all. But we got on very well with them all. And we used to shoot bows and arrows in the morning. We'd fly Mustangs in the morning, shoot bows and arrows in the afternoon, and play darts at night. So we were very, very much with it. But it was a holiday. It really was. There's nothing much we could do up there. We'd do patrols in the northern part of Japan for any shipping, and would report back any shipping we saw.
What was the general feeling in relation to the Americans and what they were doing that you could sense?
Oh, there's
from the civilian population.
Well, they were. I think they were. The Americans were treated as the victors, and being the victors, they could do what they like. If the Japanese had. They were very much a defeated nation, but very proud nation. You could see they were very proud. And they were rather horrified to think that they'd been defeated. I got on well with the Japanese. I rather liked them. There was nothing. I know people who hated them, but I found nothing to hate about them.
What are the general sort of atmosphere in relation to accepting the new ways, the American principles, the Western way.
They seem to be eager to do it. They seem to be they seem to be just getting on with their life. If the Americans told them to do something, they'd do it. They didn't do it with any ill feeling. I think they just accepted this. I think they always have, and they've come out of it pretty well by doing it, by accepting the Americans' advice.
In relation to your situation, presumably you've been here in Australia when war had finished, or you'd come back. What was the feeling like from friends and relatives to you going off again to Japan? Was there any dissuasion going on?
I was engaged to be married prior to doing this, and I thought if I went to Japan, I'd be able to save a bit of money for our marriage. But anyhow, that packed up. That engagement didn't last. I think due to the fact that I went to Japan. So there was a lot of a feeling that perhaps that we shouldn't have gone there. But a lot of the people who went up to Japan stayed on in the Air Force and became permanent Air Force. But
you mentioned the sort of aspect of being on holiday. What other stories can you relate in relation to that?
I remember going up to, when I was in Tokyo with the guard. We had quite a bit of time off, and I remember getting a jeep. And I had a sergeant who he had to drive the jeep. It was his; he was in charge of the jeep, but I could tell him where to go. So the sergeant and I went up to Nikko, it's a place in the mountains just north of Tokyo, and a holiday resort. And there was baths and entertainment, and quite a pleasant holiday up there. I think we're there for about 3 or 4 days, and altogether I enjoyed going to Japan. But of course, in looking back, it was a bad thing to do from my point of view, because I later on went into flying. If I'd started a year earlier, I'd have been far better off in the flying world. So there's pros and cons for anything you do in life, I suppose.
In relation to the way the Japanese had been defeated, and obviously you talk of their eagerness and to accept the Western principles, whatever it might be, but you also talk of them being very proud, and obviously the way they'd been defeated Must have been
a shock to them.
A strange sort of scenario to be around.
Well, it was, but of course it was all new to us, and it was all new to them. And I think people adapt pretty quickly to most situations. And it was a learning curve for everyone. I think the Japanese adapted pretty well.
People learning, obviously, about the atomic bomb. Maybe you weren't aware of it and what it had meant earlier on, but as I understand, you were to see Hiroshima. What can you tell us about that experience?
About being in Hiroshima?
Yeah.
Well, as far as I went there to have a look, and the devastation was complete. It was, I believe the bomb went off, I heard it about 8 o'clock in the morning, when they were doing all their cooking. And of course, the blast created a lot of fires everywhere, and it was just absolute devastation. And you could see that an atomic bomb goes off, there's no defence, no defence at all. It was dropped from a great height, and once it had dropped, there's no stopping it. In a way, I think that probably because of the atomic bomb, there's been no war for such a long while, because if one person gets it and uses it, they know that they'll get it back, and there's it'd devastate the world if there's an atomic war.
We can talk a little bit about the situation in relation to wars and how they may or may not have occurred since the Second World War, but the general sort of atmosphere that surrounded Hiroshima, how would you describe the feel of the place?
Oh, it was just dead. It was there was nothing left standing, and it's just a wreck of a place, completely not a building standing. They'd cleared the roads around it, so you could drive on some roads, not all of them, but we drove around in a jeep and had a look. It filled you with awe to think of the power of the atomic bomb. And we're very glad we weren't there. When we, as I say, we had a year in Japan, we came back by boat to Sydney, and then from Sydney by train to Perth, and I got out of the Air Force in June, on the 25th of June, 1947. And it was a sad day to get out. I'd been in the Air Force for 6 years, and it had its ups and downs, and in a way I can't say I enjoyed it, but I found it in a lot of ways exhilarating. I lost a lot of friends. I've made a lot of friends. So altogether it wasn't too bad.
I'm interested that you should discuss the sort of situation of returning finally. I get the impression that for a lot of people it was a letdown to finally be coming back to Perth after the experiences that they've had.
Well, yes, I found it. I think most people did. We'd been away and seen all sorts of places and done all sorts of things. It was a bit of a letdown in a way. And, of course, you didn't know what was... I went joined a stock firm after the war, and was sent to the country, and it was seemed to be a pretty flat sort of life, and I decided to apply to join the airlines, which I did, and I've stayed in the airlines ever since. I joined ANA, and then came over to Perth to Robinson Miller, and altogether I was flying in the commercial flying for about 35 years.
Was it a simple thing to get involved, to get a job in the Air Force, given the fact that you...
In the airlines?
Yeah.
Well, no, there's a great expansion of people. The airlines were expanding rapidly, and they needed pilots, and it was far easier to get into the flying game just after the war than it was later on. But, of course, in the year that I'd been away, they'd made all their captains, and the only jobs available were first officers. And I was a first officer for a couple of years, which I found a bit irksome. But it's amazing how much you learn by being a first officer. You can see all the mistakes that the captains make. Although I must tell you, have you got